Around painters, three artists, visual artists from the Caribbean. And this is a wonderful book of poetry because it has very good color illustrations of some of the paintings, sculpture in one case, of these artists. And we have Lawrence Lieberman, who has written a poetic response to these poems. So today we're going to be painting some pictures for you to see in your mind as you're driving along or listening at home to this program. And I think the words are quite vivid, and that you will appreciate the images that come to your mind through the artistry of this poet. Larry, how did you happen to come upon these artists?
Well, I was kind of sheer luck in a way. I had written some poetry about the work of a painter in St. Lucia years before, and that seemed to go okay. So I decided I would actually seek out artists in the Caribbean to learn from them, to interview them, to study their work. I knew I would do poetry, but I had no idea I would wind up writing poems about particular paintings.
Now, how did you pick the Caribbean as a place for your concentration of your writing?
Well, I lived in the Caribbean for 4 years back in the 60s. After my teaching job in Southern California, I was invited to go to the Virgin Islands to help start the college there. Hmm. And we went out there, and I was the first English department there. We lived there for about 4 years. And that was the 4 years before I came to Illinois. I really fell in love with the area and with the culture.
And you've been at the University of Illinois, an editor of the poetry series from University of Illinois Press for how long now?
Well, I started the series in 1971.
And you came here to teach when?
68.
And you retired when?
Well, my partial retirement, as I like to call it, was just this past summer. I will be teaching this spring, and I'll be teaching, you know, part-time in the springs for the next few years.
And, of course, you continue to write. It's nice being a poet that you can do that at any time of your life.
Exactly.
Well, let's not wait any longer. Let's hear some of these words. We're going to hear the title poem from the book by Lawrence Lieberman, Hour of the Mango Black Moon. And these are read over the air with permission of the author and copyright holder, Larry Lieberman, as well as the publisher, Peepal Tree Press. So let's hear first, Hour of the Mango Black Moon.
This poem, I'll just say, is a kind of meditation upon a painting entitled Morning Mangoes, by the wonderful artist Stanley Graves, originally of Guyana, who now lives in Barbados, and who came to visit here last October and did a reading with me of some of his own poetry at the Verity Gallery. this is one of the last paintings of his that I discovered on my own as I was going around Barbados, and remember phoning him to ask him questions about the process that he describes of people peeling and eating mangoes in the earliest morning. And so partly the poem reiterates a discussion that I had with him just before I left Barbados. And then it gets to the painting. Hour of the Mango Black Moon. Years back, he loved to attend the sunrise ritual of mango eating in the lagoon or bay shallows. If friends or dear ones joined you, splendid. But festive and high-spirited, he almost preferred to be thrown in with a random troop of strangers. They were all locals, your country folk, rarely foreigners, much less tourists. This ceremony was insider practice, dating back untold generations. It smacked of a history, fed on its own instant prattle of lores and enigmas. You came early, began the jabber before first light, and saved the little pouch of mangoes or bananas for daybreak. As sun rose, you peeled the fruit and lovingly carved rinds into fine lacy or jagged patterns of ornate design. Bestrewn, they would decorate the waters all about you, and the inventive shapes would catch the myriad flux of colors in ever-shifting light and keep you gasping at rainbow display. The free interchange of talk might vary from family anecdote to search and delve questions about life of the spirit, its reach beyond daily happenstance, or the fate of ghostly afterlife beings that roam the earth and maybe crawl across these haunted waters in subtle moments of eeriest light swings. Morning light, that quick change artist, needs to be watched closely, studied and sung, above all, celebrated. The talk between friends or strange first-met partners might sweep fast through all of these phases and then fall into a deep hush. Never planned, always chancy. First one and soon the others might break out into recitation of verse, inspired on-the-spot proverbs or those free flights of oratory. We began by speaking in our own voices and tongues. Then other voices might take possession of our throats, our souls, for however brief or prolonged a moment. But alas, he'd seen lavish better days ebb. Fond ritual of bolstered spirits now lost its magic, its old breed of bathers, waiters, first light worshippers gave way to slovenly ne'er-do-wells. They forsook beauty, all reverence for those sublime minutes, and fouled the waters with excess trash. In years past, the pilgrims of daybreak would tidy up after themselves, gathering many scraps and skins of fruit that littered their pristine shallows, depositing them all in plastic sacks before they slipped away. Not so the new generation of mango pals. Too often, whole weeks of rotting and putrid leavings, peels layered upon peels, effused odors of rank malediction, a gross pestilence of the scummy surface. Most radiant colors would be bleached to a no-color off-white. Dead fish belly-up shades. In the painting Morning Mangoes, an elegy for lost dawn glow heyday, the brown woman and man, standing in bay water that just covers their knees, are entranced. The red pupils of their eyes gleam like miniature suns. Their eye whites darken to jet-black gemstones. The iris is yellow-orange, mango-colored. A sharp horizon line bisects their high foreheads. An oversized, flamy semicircle of rising sun forms a perfect wide arch over their heads, a crystalline blend of white and scarlet. Curved like a tall rainbow on the horizon, it frames their faces. The sea, dark blue at the skyline, lightens gradually downwards toward their submerged knees and forelegs. He holds two red mangoes, she two yellows, one in each hand, four ripe fruit, just peeled and ready to eat. Each lifts the larger towards the other's mouth to offer a bite. A cryptic black oval, shaped like a gigantic mango, rests on the distant sea surface, balanced on end. It could be the moon, its color reversed to black, like the lover's eye whites, blackened by a mischievous sun's alchemy. A cherry and its wide leaf sprout on curled stems from his visor cap. Another stemless leaf, grown backward from his neck. Her hat, that many-layered pancake of mango skins thick-piled on her head, long narrow leaves trailing out behind her neck like scarf ends. But we mustn't miss the humor of their uniquely fashioned plump body parts. Their hands are rounded melons. Necks, forearms, and upper arm segments, all comic oblongs loosely strung together on thread-slim joints like marionettes. Their globular limbs are composites of elongated mango shapes. You are what you eat, carried to that playful metamorphosis of forms. He, garbed in yellow bathing suit and red hat. She, wearing her yellow mango peel headdress, sports three red cherries growing from the top of her one-piece crimson swimsuit. They are both encompassed by floating curlicues of banana and mango peels. The water surface woven into a mishmash, vivid tapestry of silks. Half-risen sun strikes upper layers near the waiter's sashaying dark torsos with bright streaks of turquoise, gold, and sparkly orange, buoying their frolicsome arms and shoulders toward a new light suppleness. They bob and pitch with puppets' wild spring.
We've just heard Lawrence Lieberman read his poem Hour of the Mango Black Moon, a meditation, a reflection on a painting by the artist Stanley, it's pronounced Graves, G-R-E-A-V-E-S, Stanley Graves. The painting is titled Morning Mangoes. It was painted in 1989. Larry Lieberman's poem is published in a book by the same title, Hour of the Mango Black Moon, published just last year, 2004, by Peepal Tree Press in England, and read by on the air by permission of the press and the author and reader, Larry Lieberman. Larry, let's talk about this poem a little bit, and I might explain to listeners that although you may be used to hearing short poems read on the radio, perhaps with Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac on this station, this is a narrative poem. This is a poem that tells a story about an artist, in this case a poet's encounter with a work of visual art. And I thought it appropriate to stretch your imaginations a bit and listen to the whole piece. It goes four pages in the book. The book has an unusual format. It's basically square, and Larry, your lines of poetry are longer than many people are used to seeing these days. How did you make that choice?
Well, from quite a ways back, I have been a fond admirer of poets like Hart Crane and Marianne Moore, and loved the lush language and the feel of the wide stanza. I think those were early models of mine, certainly. In recent times, I find that more and more I'm writing first drafts of poems in a kind of prosy, rough, free verse. And then finally I come back to this rough verse and start shaping it into stanzas.
And so your poetry has been described by readers, I suppose kind critics, we could say, as a free verse that has a pattern to the arrangement of the lines, of the words on the page that form a pleasing pattern. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is fair, and in some ways I don't even want to call it free verse because I'm very carefully counting syllables and devising a patterned stanza of syllable count lines, which is roughly repeated throughout the poem, sometimes with alternate shaped stanzas.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes traditional rhymes appear, but not often in traditional places.
That would be fair.
Okay.
I used to write more rhyming poems, mm-hmm. and hope to go back to it.
And there's been a big movement in this country, and I guess in English poetry in general, towards more traditional forms. But most of your books have been, it would be fair to say, are free verse, even though you're counting.
Right.
Have you always counted syllables? And
no, I have gone through different phases, but I've nearly always written poems in which I've fairly carefully measured the lines, mm-hmm. whether by counting the accented accents, as in more formally metered poetry, or syllables, and for the most part, I'm doing one or the other for in all my new work.
And since many of our readers may not have seen some of your recent books, let me describe a few things that I see. Some of your words are arranged so that they form almost a large circle on a whole page. Some of them, there are parts which are italicized. Sometimes you use that as a way to indicate a conversation.
Yes.
or verbal character speaking in the in the poems. Sometimes you have the margin on the right in a straight line. And these are all choices partly for the visual appearance, but also to emphasize a change in the direction the poem is moving, perhaps?
I think that would be fair.
Okay.
Occasionally, there has been maybe an obvious or direct reason for a particular shape in a poem in relation to the subject or in relation to the painting in the book. But nearly always, it's just a random discovery. I try to keep myself surprised with discovering new shapes and new forms.
Let me explain to regular listeners that Keeping the Faith this afternoon has been taped, has been recorded prior to its broadcast. Ordinarily, these are live programs, and listeners may call in with a comment or a question or perhaps a bit of poetry of their own. However, today, because of scheduling difficulties, we've needed to record this program you're hearing earlier this week. So we will not be announcing phone numbers, and we will not be taking listeners' calls this week. However, we'll return to that format next week when, incidentally, we have another poet on the program, the current poet laureate for the state of Illinois, Kevin Stein, who will be reading from his book, American Ghost Roses, which was published by University of Illinois Press and edited by our guest this week, Professor Lawrence Lieberman.
And a wonderful book of Kevin Stein's it is.
And it's kind of a reflection on the death of his father.
Yes, it is.
In many different forms.
Much of it is.
A moving book. Well, let's get back to our guest for today as poet, not as editor, Lawrence Lieberman. And could I ask you to select a second poem for us to hear on the air? And again, I'll repeat, these are poems from Larry Lieberman's most recent book, published in 2004, Hour of the Mango Black Moon, which reflect on responses to the visual paintings, sculpture of three different Caribbean artists. Who's next?
Well, I'm going to read a poem by the painter Ross Aishi, and the poem is entitled Marooned. I'll just say a word about how I happened to write this one. It's about a painting called Isolation. As with the other two artists, I had scheduled an interview with Ross Aishi, and it was in a hotel gallery where so many of his paintings were on display. And
now, in what country?
It was in Barbados, which is where I met all three of them. And just before our appointment, a man showed up wearing a turban who walked up to me as if he knew me. And I asked him if he was Ross Aishi, and he said yes. And Ross Aishi, being a very distinguished and well-known artist in the island, and he was really kind of playing me along. It wasn't Ross Aishi. It was an imposter. Then when Aishi suddenly showed up about 5 minutes later, I recognized his face from the self-portrait in this painting, Isolation. The poem is entitled Marooned. I'm fooled by the tall, turbaned, white, shirt-jacked fellow, bouncy in his white Nikes, an imposter who tries to pass for the noted artist Ross Aishi. When Aishi does appear, shy and wavering in his glance, I just know I've met him before. So elusive was his face in the self-portrait, Isolation, I hardly knew I'd taken it in until now. The man before me, in loose-fitting caftan and spare sandals, near speechless at first, as I, throws me back into the face silhouette at the painting's center. His living visage at a glance gives me the key to re-enter the all-but-hidden dotted-line features of a lonely tranced being on the free-floating cosmos. Marooned, he says he is. Black artist in his island element. Whoever he may be seems a void in need of filling. And here, the space of himself is invaded by sparkly points and slivers and jewels of varicolored lights, glittering tiny bodies, stars or planets, a few satellites and meteors among them, perhaps, All those celestial luminaries of night sky pageant flow in and out of his dimlit demeanor as if his flesh be immaterial and transparent. Vast distances of outer space, we come to feel, are filtered and woven into his palpable vision. Austere, calm gaze reveals he's not squelched by the invasive planetary masses, nor robbed of his overt physiognomy, an exterior crust of flesh and hair. Rather, his transparency shows he can contain this fiery and pulsing cosmos in mindscape. Is the nearest submerged face portrait a lost soul? Rudderless vessel awash in the great sea of outer space? Or does Aishi contain and command the abyss of star clusters, man a guiding center to galaxies, his emptiness filled with riches of jeweled other worlds? Surprise gateway. He has voyaged from finding himself lost to losing himself found at a single cosmic leap.
Now, as you read that poem, you skipped in the middle, and so I'll tell listeners if they want to have the whole experience, they'll have to pick up the book at a library pick it up at a bookstore or online. Now, some poets consider their words almost sacred, and so they would never skip and leave out a middle section like you chose to do on the radio. How do you make a judgment about that? Now, the part you skipped is a part that can be left out, and the story continues. But how do you make a decision like that?
Well, I've found as I've been giving readings, most recently in England, because I've just come back from a tour a week ago, that since my time is limited and I want to give people a sense of the variety of the work, that at times I'm reading excerpts of poems rather than whole poems. In this case, it just seemed natural to give a feeling for the whole poem with the first part and the last.
We've just heard the poet Lawrence Lieberman reading his poem titled Marooned, a response to a painting by the visual artist from the Caribbean, Ross Ishii, I-S-H-I. His painting is called Isolation, 1995 work. When we've tried to pick out certain poems from this collection, Larry, that dealt with spiritual themes, themes of religion, ethics, broadly spoken, some of these popped into your mind, and it happened they did to mine as well, and we had several that we each agreed would be good to read on the air. What in this poem made you think it would fit a program called Keeping the Faith? You've recently read your work on BBC in England, but why for this program did this poem come to your mind?
The one I just read.
Yes,
Maroon.
The one you just read.
It seems to me a very deeply spiritual poem. Mm-hmm. I responded to the painting as being an extraordinarily uplifting work of the artist envisioning his own spirit in relation to the entire cosmos somehow as a kind of symbol too of his sense of isolation in the universe and his ability to transcend that isolation through his prevailing spirit.
In the time you've spent in the Caribbean, is it a communal culture, or is the individualism that's so prevalent in North America more typically found there?
I would say it's more deeply a communal culture.
Uh-huh.
Very definitely.
Uh-huh.
Very strong sense of community.
And so this artist, Ross Ishii, seeing himself as isolated he's not in favor of that.
No, he's not. And as a matter of fact, in my interview with him, what I learned is that before he became, if you will, a fine artist, he was a craftsman in several other art forms, jewelry making, and batik work in particular. And he resisted becoming a fine artist because he didn't want to put himself apart from the common man and from the everyday laborer, the blue-collar worker. His profoundest respect goes out to these people rather than to, as he would say, artists who so often may seem to be super egos.
We're about halfway through our program today. We've heard two poems from Hour of the Mango Black Moon, collection of poetry by Lawrence Lieberman, published by Peepal Tree Press in England and available in this country as well. Let me take just a moment to introduce myself. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for this program. And next week, as I mentioned earlier, I'll be interviewing Kevin Stein, current poet laureate for the state of Illinois, about his most recent book, American Ghost Roses, published by University of Illinois Press. And that poetry series is edited by our guest today, Professor Lawrence Lieberman. On December 18, my guest will be Father George Pyle from the Greek Orthodox Church, Three Hierarchs Congregation in Champaign. And we'll be talking about keeping the holidays holy, talking about the secular encroachment into the feast days. That's Father Pyle on December 18. And on December 25th, another pre-recorded program, as this one is, Cliff Kindy will be our guest from the Church of the Brethren. He was on a peacemaking team that spent the last 5 months in Iraq. He's done that each of the last 3 years, once before the war and twice since, and will be talking with us about what he saw during his months there as part of a peacemaking team working with Muslims and Christians and Jews and others in Iraq. So those are programs coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It came here in 1873, just 6 years after the university began, was begun by students. And since that time, for the last 133 years almost now, has been developing student leadership skills by providing opportunities for community service for students, for social action. And Y students are very active in this community, providing tutoring to kids in need and doing service projects here and really around the country during our service breaks, working on environmental issues, a very active student organization that I'm proud to be associated with. The Y is a charity, and as we approach the end of the year, if you would like to consider making a donation to help the University Y continue its mission on this particular campus, do contact me. My name again is Steve Shoemaker. My phone number is 217-337-1500. One of the programs the Y is setting up for next semester is called Communiversity. And we have students and faculty and community people who want to teach something, not for credit, but for fun. And instructors can make a little bit of money, and a little bit of money comes to the Y from people who want to take these courses. But we have courses in all sorts of things, hobbies and crafts and things people are interested in, maybe even poetry writing. And so if you'd like to teach a class, do give us a call. Ask for Paul at the Y. That's 337-1514. And those classes will be starting up in January. We do need to hear from potential instructors before the end of this year. Well, let's get back to our guest, Professor Lawrence Lieberman, reading from his book, Hour of the Mango, Black Moon, set in the, you say Caribbean or Caribbean?
You know, I keep hearing it both ways.
Let's go to another artist and another poem. What have you chosen?
Well, I'd like to read a poem now by Ross Akyem, and he's the third artist that I've been working with in this book. He did a whole series of paintings in which mythic figures of biblical and historic, have been re-envisioned, if you will, as black men. There's a poem about Hannibal, and there's one about Daniel, and there's certainly one about Christ. But in this case, in this case, it's a painting dealing with Moses, and Moses re-envisioned as a black man. This is the one that I'd like to read my meditative poem, if you will.
And the title of this is When the Waters Returned.
Right. In my interview with Ross Akyem, I learned that there was a particular passage in the Bible that had prompted this painting. And the passage is the following. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. Exodus 14:28. So my poem's title is taken from that passage of Scripture, When the Waters Returned. Dark-skinned Moses, a man of color, crowned and bearded with loopy tubular design, is seated at leisure. So it seems, for he contemplates his next moves in a chess game with the Pharaoh. A white knight emblazoned on his red robe front stands victorious beside the blank square marked with an X from which Pharaoh's king was toppled, his little black crown knocked off and pushed to one side. Pharaoh has been checkmated. Now Moses clutches his serpent rod with both hands, all 10 fingers knottily intertwined around this black staff, which parts the Red Sea neatly below his robes. But in the left panel, long moments later, glint formless red streaks and smears amid a topsy-turvy whirl of little boats and howling gape-jawed figures. For those held-apart halves of sea now sweep back, re-merging around Pharaoh's legions. Loose chariot wheels are flying, while 6 drowning soldiers tumble and somersault from side to side. A big black fishhook, looped for a catch, hangs above the green and blue medley of sea and sky intermixed. The elements whipped into such a frenzy, the blurred horizon lines just barely visible between them. The dangled hook signifies lure of magic pathway through the sea, which drew Pharaoh's army to give chase across the oddly uncovered seafloor in pursuit of the fugitive Israelites. The armies took the bait and rushed to embrace their massacre. The great patriarch's face is serene. His work is all cool laboring with the spirit. A passive pose, meditation, shrewdly conceals the huge effort of his inner mind. Our man of God, half mortal, half angel, directs that barbarous scenario of upheaval in the left panel. His eyes seem to look away, glancing to the side opposite that havoc at sea, perhaps to fool his enemy, throwing Pharaoh off guard. Those blue and red geometric color blocks of his face composite seem to match his flowing robes, dark blue chair bottom and chair arms. His illusion of quiet repose is so total, he may appear to dreamily nod off into lulled absence. But his face colors hide slow cunning of a chameleon, that false veneer a guise of laxity to befuddle his opponent. And Moses' suavely chiseled hands, his knuckle-creased fingers interlocked and molded like oaken logs around his long black cane, tell another story. The olive-green pale glimmer of his sculpturesque fingers, each gnarly digit carved to precise scale, looks eerily akin to the shades of yellow-green whirling across the tumult and roil-up of sea surface. Paint colorous key reveals that the agent who wields those luminous appendages is the secret mover behind the maelstrom of wind and waves. That viper head on his walking stick is no mere ornament or decoration, its long wicked tongue slithering out between two rows of white fangs. A twin snake head, half veiled at the far left panel, appears to preside over that melee and fracas of typhoon which engulfs the Egyptian warriors. The airborne snake metes out havoc, punishments of the tempest. A subaltern miracle maker in the employ of chief conjurer Moses, much as Ariel served Prospero. And Moses' red robes seem to flow hauntingly into the parted waters of the Red Sea below his magic wand, topped by the hissing snakehead. Robes and sea wreck, too, seem conjoined in a cult discourse. The master's cloak, yet another agent of his sorcery. All messages to be read into this portrait's color code. In Akyem's painting Moses, racial or ethnic crossovers are the norm in storied oils. Black Moses is every man, any time, both then and now. Part human, part saintly, he's less one hero of legend than a vital oasis in our aggregate mortal soul. All of nature, wind and waters, abyssal gulfs and rocky cliffs, conspires to bring off this miracle. We may all partake of the paint-embroidered weave. Who now enters this work's trance and broods on its moves in and out of time may be the Black Jew, green-fingered snake charmer, crowned and bearded spirit overlord, who feigns idleness as he ever plots the collapse of empires.
We've just heard a reading of the poem When the Waters Returned by Lawrence Lieberman, read by the poet, a response to the oil painting by the artist Raz Akyem, A-K-Y-E-M, of Barbados. The painting is a 1995 work entitled Moses. This is included in Lawrence Lieberman's most recent book, Hour of the Mango Black Moon, published by Peepal Tree Press and read by permission of the publisher and the copyright holder, the poet. Thank you, Larry. This is another narrative poem, patterned free verse, as it's been called, and dealing with a subject from the Hebrew Bible, in this case from Exodus, When the Waters Returned. I was thinking when I read this poem that some scholars of the Jewish scriptures believe that perhaps the earliest fragment of writing in the Torah is that bit of poetry attributed to Miriam, the sister of Moses, describing the horse and the rider being thrown into the sea. Some think that may be the oldest fragment that was later editors included in the Torah. So it's fitting that a poetic response dealing with this now, who knows how many millennia later.
Right. That's utterly fascinating, and I'm tempted now to want to ask the artist if that particular passage may also have prompted his painting.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are three living artists, and you've interviewed all of them, as well as responded to their paintings in a poetic form. What did they think about your project?
Well, to tell you the truth, I had a lot of trepidation about these poems and whether the artist would approve of them or not.
Sure.
I originally wrote them with the idea that they would all stand by themselves without people seeing the paintings. And indeed, a good many of them were accepted by American magazines. As the first couple of poems were about to appear in the magazines, I thought, uh-oh, I better check with the artists and make sure that they're comfortable with the poems. And I phoned Stanley Graves in Barbados, told him, and he said, please send the poems. He felt reasonably confident they would be all right. And I did send them all, and luckily for me, they were happy with them. And indeed, all appeared at the readings that Stanley Graves and I did in Barbados for a week back in April, kind of homecoming earlier this year.
But the poems are an interpretation of the paintings.
Indeed.
Now, you're careful to describe the painting as to what's there, and then you also make clear when you're perhaps guessing what this may mean, what it may imply. And, of course, in your poem, as you tell the story of your encounter with the painting, you also tie it to current issues of our time, as in this last poem, the whole issue of empire.
I'd like to believe that I'm finding my own mythology, mm-hmm. secretly, if you will, in the mythology that the painters have provided. The paintings I've written about are the ones that I feel that I've deeply connected with in some spiritual part of my own psyche, so that I'm trying to discover, if you will, my own vision through their vision. At the same time, I try to be as accurate as I possibly can, both in describing what is literally in the painting, and indeed, and try to be true to the spirit of the vision as it has been explained to me in the interviews. So there's several different strands all coming together for me as the poem unfolds.
But you don't seem to hesitate to form your own judgment, even if I'm guessing it may not have been something that the artist themselves told you. So you must believe that a painting may carry more than even the artist knows them, that the artists themselves may be aware of.
Absolutely, which is indeed what I feel when I'm writing a poem, mm-hmm. That a reader hopefully will find in it much more than I thought I was condensing into the poem as I wrote it.
Well, let's give you a chance to hear someone interpret one of your poems. I warned Larry that I would be doing this and ask his permission. But he has another book that's has been published in England, but is not available in this country yet. But when it comes out here, we'll try to invite Larry back to be on this program and read some from it and talk about that book. It is called Carib's Leap, and I'm fortunate to have a pre-U.S. publication copy of the title poem from that book. And that book will also be dealing with your poetic response to paintings by some of these same artists. Is that correct?
Actually, it's a selected poems that draws on many previous books of mine,
and then
a section of new poems. So it's really a selected and new poems.
Okay, but the Banana Madonna poem is a new poem?
No.
Has it been published?
It's one of the earlier poems about an artist in St. Lucia, a great muralist by the name of Dunstan St. Omer.
Tell us about the Banana Madonna before I read it.
Well, Derek Walcott's great friend in St. Lucia, Dunstan St. Omer, the muralist, befriended me when I first went to St. Lucia, and I spent several weeks visiting with him and his family, and he drove me to various parts of the island where his paintings were. But on this one occasion, he didn't give me forewarning that we were about to look at a stained glass window. And the car came up to the church and then suddenly, abruptly stopped. And there we were looking at the window. And he did almost a kind of ballet with his arms as he described to me various portions of the painting in the window.
Now, tell me how to pronounce, since I've not been to this part of the Caribbean, is it how to pronounce R-O-S-E-A-U, the valley where the Valley Church is?
Roseau.
Roseau. Here, then, is my reading of The Banana Madonna by Lawrence Lieberman, which will be found in his book, Carib's Leap. The Banana Madonna. En route to Roseau Valley Church, we passed defunct sugar mills, a few kept up as ruins, followed by lush crops of banana trees and coconut palms, both casting much shade and cooling our passage through St. Lucia's rolling pastures. Banana images, profuse in local church art, glut our talk. Never have I seen so many unpicked bananas at once. This plantation, the richest so near to harvest, the thousands of green firm tubes wrapped in bundles, thousands of green hands upon hands upon hands, fingers woven together, wound about stalks and vines. It's the great siesta of banana trees. The proliferant orchards doze, pater and mater familius banana, sleeping the long repose of blessed hands crossed in their laps, crossed over ample bellies, green fingers interlocked. Sleep, the sleep of bananas, toward harvest, while the sun's slow yellow light seeps, dilutes the vine-tough green of rinds. I dream the slow, quiet goldening of the crops. We leave behind the last plantation, bear right down an elegant short cobblestone side road. Here, stop. The church's brick face leaps in front of my hood before the road gives any sign of quitting. Our engine idling, we step from the car. My eye follows golden loops in the jigsaw pattern of stained glass paneling in the tall windows raised above our windshield. Two bright halos highlight the upper panes, many panels of varied colors fitted into a composite design below. Your arms, shaping coils and parabolas in the air over our heads, guide my view from the halo above the mahogany-haired woman's forehead locks to the marvelous flowing banana forms, arched like horseshoes, boomerangs, erect phalluses, but always the banana is the norm. All bold variations branch away from or return to. Likewise, the borders and outer fragments of stained glass mosaic are all banana twists. They begin outside the portrait's visible outline, but undulate deep into the midsection of the tableau. Other banana twirls and prongs, snaking around margins of the painting, appear to flow into the banana orchards in neighbor plantations. The lines of crops we've just passed in our Datsun, repeated in the crisscrossing color veins of glass. Banana shapes not merely copied, but transplanted. Ivy climbing the church's walls and sending forked twin vines across nearby fields blends nature and wall no more seamlessly than stained glass banana designs, which intertwine the faces and necks of mother and child suckling her breast. Strings of half-peeled bananas swirl into the mother's neck veins, her breast veins. The child, perhaps, imbibes banana milk, while mother and child alike inhale banana-flavored air. She is my banana Madonna, you are saying, and yes, faces and busts of baby Madonna seem a tapestry woven of banana vines, half-opened banana peels, silhouettes of bulky, unpeeled bananas winding around frames of glass panels overspill their outlines. Banana curves and loops flow into curlicues that become the mother's earlobe, her dimpled chin, long slanted neck, the baby's puffed cheek. Bananas, the leaf, stem, root. Madonna and child, the blossom, ripe fruit of stained glass, to be plucked by the congregation's eye. The poem, The Banana Madonna, by Lawrence Lieberman, from his soon-to-be published in the U.S., Caribs Leap, C-A-R-I-B apostrophe S, L-E-A-P, Caribs Leap. Thank you, Larry, for letting me read that.
Well, thank you for the wonderful reading. I feel like I've never heard that poem before now that I've heard your reading of it. And I must say the poem belongs to you. You have made it your own.
Well, thank you. I was moved by it. It is interesting to hear other people read your work, isn't it?
It's marvelous.
They do. They may hear something different or see something maybe than perhaps even you did.
It really is a discovery to hear it as you read it.
Uh-huh. But I may well have misinterpreted some things. Were the things you sort of cringed at?
No.
You can be honest here. It's just you and me talking.
Well, no, really, I feel that the poem has been renewed for me by hearing your reading of it. It becomes altogether a new experience.
Well, you're very kind. I look forward to seeing the book when it is published in this country next year, and I do hope you can find a way to be on the program for us again and as we look at that book. Let's talk a little bit in our short minutes remaining of poetry in general these days. There seem to be more poets than there are readers of poetry. I notice in Ted Kooser's column that he's recently started in the paper as the National Poet Laureate that is published in newspapers around the country, selections of poetry that he's chosen, that he's very careful to say after he says a little bit about the poet and publishes the short poem, he then says, this has been published as with permission of the press and the author, but he also says, but don't send us your poems. He's made his selection, but he doesn't want to be inundated by people who write. Why are there more writers than readers of poetry in America today?
You know, I totally agree with you. The problem is that many people who write poetry, this is my experience as a teacher as well as a reader, just haven't bothered, if you will, to train themselves in the very difficult discipline of careful readership, and it shows in what they write. As becoming acquainted with any art form, classical music, or indeed painting or sculpture, one has to struggle to learn that language, and to come into the feel for the medium before, in my opinion, trying to create new works in that medium. What I'm saying is, and indeed I agree with Ted Kooser in this, what we need to do is encourage people to do more reading. And as much of a variety, a range of reading of good poetry as possible, either before they actually write their own poetry or at least alongside.
I was at the First Presbyterian Church of Urbana last Sunday where I've been asked to lead a few Sunday school classes for adults for a few weeks, and I was copying something that I wanted to pass out to the class at the church copy machine. And above it on the bulletin board that gave you instructions on how to use it and so on, there was a quotation by Goethe. Now, this is typical of a university community, right, that they wouldn't have a cartoon of Dagwood or something, but they'd have a quotation from Goethe. But the quotation was, and I can't remember, I don't have it memorized, but it said something like, for us to escape our common day-to-day cares, we should each day see a painting, read a poem, and hear some beautiful music. And I think in our culture, we've forgotten those things.
It sounds to me like a wonderful prescription for a daily ritual that we could all do much worse than follow. Uh-huh. And I agree with you. Somehow in our culture, we have lost that solid commitment to nourishing our spirits with regularity, mm-hmm. Indeed, every day.
You mentioned some of the classic poets of the previous century, Marianne Moore earlier. Who do you read today? What living poets do you like to read?
Oh, there are a great many. poets in my own language, among my favorites today, among living poets, I would name Mark Strand, William Stafford, who died a few years ago, Robert Lowell. I want to mention people like Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. I mean,
No, I said living.
there's so much alive for me that I can't believe that they've died.
We're fortunate in our time now with the internet to have access, even if we don't have the books on our shelves, to be able to see so many of these things as close as our computers, the writings of the past masters. We can no longer complain it would take too long to walk to the library, because if we have a computer, those works are there. And yet so often it seems like people don't make those choices. Do you find that in your students?
I do indeed. And I forgive me for wanting to mention that we have a lot of wonderful poets in Illinois that ought to be right at the top of the list. And your poet for next week, Kevin Stein, indeed is one of them. Others would be G.E. Murray, John Knopfel, Michael Van Walligen, a number of wonderful Illinois poets that we've been publishing at University of Illinois Press, Bridget Begin Kelly, who teaches on our faculty at Illinois.
And of Illinois poets, I think of the late John Frederick Nims.
Indeed.
Right. Well, we've about run out of our time. We've been talking today with Lawrence Lieberman, L-I-E-B-E-R-M-A-N. Larry is the author of Hour of the Mango Black Moon, his most recently published book in America by Peepal Tree Press from England. His next book, Carib's Leap, has been published in England and will be published here, available here after the first of the year. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'm privileged, as Larry just mentioned, to be interviewing and hearing him read some of his own poems, the Illinois State Poet Laureate, Kevin Stein, S-T-E-I-N. He'll be reading from his most recent book, American Ghost Roses. Coming up later in December, we'll be going back to next week our live format, and also when we talk with George Pyle on the 18th. Father Pyle is a priest of the Greek Orthodox Church, and we'll be talking about the secular encroachment into the feast days, how to keep the holidays holy. He'll be speaking from a Greek Orthodox Christian perspective. And our guest December 25th will be Cliff Kindy, who recently spent 5 months in Iraq as part of a peacemaking team. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we consider the good stuff. Love, poetry, pleasure, chocolate, art, beauty. New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman says the beauty of beauty is that it's unfixed. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you can join us for Beauty, the Backcountry, Sex, Jazz, and More, under the best of our knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. PRI's The World covers your day around the globe. It takes you inside the news wherever it's happening. You hear reports from its worldwide network of BBC correspondents. You meet people who are affected by the day's events. And you examine culture and controversies brewing overseas. Join us for America's only daily program with a global perspective. Listen to The World, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. here on AM 580, WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low around 11 degrees and northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the mid-20s and west winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low around 15 degrees and light winds. You're listening to WILL Urbana, public radio for Central Illinois. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.
It's a classic David and Goliath situation. Younger sister and older sister. In this case, it's a big age gap. The older sister's 12, that's Kennedy. The younger sister's just 5, that's Zadie. And their mom, who was an only child, found their fighting to be kind of overwhelming.
They bicker constantly, like they just fight and are at each other.
I'm
Z.
It's not physical, but it's a constant natter. It's a constant back and forth.
And so 2 months ago, their mom, Lisa, came up with an idea, a way to change things between the two girls. She and I talked about it back then. You're going to notice in this recording that I have a pretty bad cold when we had this conversation. At the time, Lisa described for me the girls' history together.
Once Sadie realized, when she was about two, that Kennedy was